for LGBTQ people to be able to live and thrive without fear of discrimination. It's not enough to be protected from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. The strategy also presented a practical dilemma. Yes, employment protections are arguably the most important area of life. But if we pass the most popular part of our agenda by itself, the more controversial parts that we leave for later become even harder to pass. I wasn't inspired by this approach, but it was the strategy I was joining. And I was just one junior member of one team in one of a handful of organizations working on these issues. And in the end, I was thrilled to be able to continue to work on something that I was passionate about at one of the nation's leading advocacy organizations. As I prepared for my first day at CAP, Andy and I moved into a new apartment together. Our new place was in the same building as his old apartment, but in making the decision and signing the lease together, it truly felt like our home. I had fallen in love with the apartment because of its gorgeous views of a park across the street. The large windows in our living room looked out over stately trees that parted in the middle to reveal a long grassy stretch, frequently filled with picnickers, and on Sunday, a drum circle. When I told friends that I would be going to work with Andy, several questioned, "Don't you think it'll be hard to work with your boyfriend?" We'd now be living together, commuting together, and at CAP, our desks would be only about 20 feet apart. For some, it would be a recipe for disaster. Both of us loved every minute of it. Some of our colleagues didn't even know we were dating. We kept it as professional as possible at work, relegating our more couple-y talk to Gmail and Facebook messages. Between calls with coalition partners and researching and writing on issues of equality, Andy would message me his traditional greeting of, "Hello, is a bean there?" We did a pretty good job of keeping our professional lives separate from our home lives, focusing as we always had on cooking together and watching mindless reality shows to unplug at the end of the day. Other days, though, we would vent to each other about something outrageous or hilarious that had happened. After all, our jobs were a big part of our identities, and our work was inherently personal for both of us. We squabbled and bickered, as any couple would, but the fights were always mild and quickly resolved. We were happy together, and each inspired by our work. We capped each week with Andy's signature sangria on our rooftop and views of the Washington Monument and Jefferson Memorial. It was a pretty good life. Throughout the summer and early fall of 2013, as two young transgender people falling in love and fighting for the community we love, it seemed like we had a world of possibility and potential before us. I was 23 years old, and I felt more fulfilled and happier than I'd ever imagined. But that all changed when Andy went in for a doctor's appointment in September. Back in March, while we were on vacation in Barbados, Andy had started to complain about a sore on his tongue. Months went by, but the sore remained. By August, I was getting a little annoyed with him. The pain was beginning to sour his mood, and I was agitated by the mood swings. "Go see a doctor. You need to do something," I said, probably not fully grasping the pain he was in. Eventually, I joined him at a small surgery center in suburban Washington for a short outpatient procedure to get rid of the sore. We'd assumed that it was just a benign growth on his tongue, uncomfortable but easy to fix. It never occurred to us that the situation would be more than just a nuisance. Even after the doctor stopped the procedure early, saying that the growth was a bit larger than he'd anticipated, we were still completely unfazed. Young invincibles is what they call people like Andy and me. The thought of illness for young people like us is so abstract that many don't even bother to purchase health insurance. While we were insured through our employer, the obvious never occurred to us. In retrospect, our obliviousness feels absurd. A week after the aborted outpatient procedure, Andy went in for a follow-up that quickly crushed any feeling of invincibility. I was home in Delaware visiting my parents, and we didn't expect it to be anything but a simple follow-up. Driving back to D.C. on my way to work, I got a call from Andy. "Are you in a place to talk?" he asked me, his voice a bit shaky. "I'm pulling into the garage at the office right now, but what's up?" I nervously asked. "Just call me back when you aren't driving," he replied. If the thought of serious illness had been non-existent before, it all came rushing into my head at once. I immediately knew where this was headed. No, what's going on? I pushed. He paused for a moment and cleared his throat. I have cancer. I have cancer. Three life-changing words you never want to hear. He sounded completely defeated. Still driving down into the lower levels of my office's garage, I could barely say anything before my cell reception started to go. I got out of my car and ran upstairs to my boss. When I reached her office, I was out of breath. My knees were weak, and I felt like I was going to throw up. I told her I needed to leave. I was hesitant to share Andy's information, particularly since my boss was also his boss, and I felt like it was his place to share that information. But I also needed to explain why I had to leave. Andy, it felt surreal to say the words myself. Andy just found out that he has cancer. I felt like my world was upside down. I felt like I was propelling forward without any idea of where or how Andy and I would land. Go, my boss responded, immediately understanding my need to be by Andy's side. I raced back to our apartment. It felt oddly still and calm as I burst in. The juxtaposition of my racing and cluttered mind and the deafening silence of the apartment was jarring. I walked through our small front hall and found Andy sitting on our couch, deep in thought, staring straight ahead. I ran over to him and gave him a big hug, interrupting an almost trance-like look on his face. He told me that the doctors had explained that the tests of the cells from the growth had come back and that it was malignant oral cancer, specifically tongue cancer. They weren't entirely sure how much there was, but it was possible it had spread to the throat and the lymph nodes in the neck. I think for anyone, when they hear that they or a loved one has been diagnosed with cancer, their minds almost immediately jump to the ultimate fear, death. I know mine did, and I'm sure Andy's went there as well, but we didn't talk about that possibility, at least not yet. Still, a dark conversation we had just a few weeks before was at the front of my mind as I tried to comfort Andy. Driving around doing errands, we had started talking about our biggest fears, and both of us had expressed just how scared of death we were. No, you don't understand, Bean, he told me as I drove us to Target. The degree that I'm scared of death is unique. Some people are resigned to fate, but I'm not. I think about death a lot, more than most people. Sitting on the couch in our apartment a few weeks later, he didn't have to remind me of that conversation or verbalize that fear. It was self-evident. As Andy called his parents and step-parents in Wisconsin to tell them the frightening news, I stepped out of the apartment and called my parents. Oh my God, my mom exclaimed and began to cry. Call Sean, she said. My older brother had recently begun working as a radiation oncologist at Memorial Sloan Kettering in New York City, one of the nation's premier cancer hospitals. Of all the focuses Sean could have decided on, he happened to be specializing in head and neck cancer, the very kind of cancer Andy had just been diagnosed with. Pacing outside our apartment building's back door and under a bright, flickering orange fluorescent light, I peppered Sean with a million questions, some heavy, others more superficial. Will Andy lose his hair? Probably not. While he couldn't provide me with too many specifics because he hadn't seen Andy's records, he told me that the likeliest path forward would be surgery, followed by radiation and chemotherapy. He described the surgery, a likely significant dissection of Andy's tongue, which would require a graft from his arm to rebuild the removed part. Is he going to be able to talk after that? Most likely, but it depends on how far the cancer is spread and exactly where it is in his tongue. Most likely, I thought. Jesus Christ. I was scared to ask the question that was at the front of my mind. I was afraid of the answer. All of my questions danced around the central issue. I couldn't ask, is he going to die? What if I ended up knowing more about Andy's future than he did? What if the prognosis wasn't good? My role now was to be the moral support for Andy as he underwent treatment. And I knew that if I appeared pessimistic in the least, he would be able to sense it. I don't know what to do, Sean. I felt completely overwhelmed. a feeling that I'm sure paled in comparison to the fear that was consuming Andy. Have Andy's records sent to me. I'll take a look and I'll see if I can get him into Johns Hopkins, he reassured me, referring to the major hospital in Baltimore that, like Memorial Sloan Kettering in New York, was known as a leader in cancer treatment. The next few days were oddly normal as we began to scout out treatment options. Andy and I went into work, we cooked and watched our shows, but throughout everything, the cloud of cancer hovered, both of us bracing for an impending storm. Sean managed to get us into Hopkins. As we drove the 30 minutes up to Baltimore for our consultation before surgery, we knew how lucky we were to have access to the resources and skills that would no doubt aid Andy's chances at a successful treatment. This is already so scary. I can't imagine having to do this without Sean's help and guidance, Andy told me. Just like with my coming out 2 years before, Sean had rushed into the situation as a reassuring voice of support. Now he was helping to shepherd my boyfriend through what already seemed to be very serious cancer. Almost no one has an ally like Sean to help them to get the best possible care available. Many do not even have access to health insurance, something that took the cost of Andy's treatment down from well over $100,000 to a few copays. Fortunately, by the time of our appointment, we were feeling optimistic that with aggressive and competent treatment, Andy's cancer was curable. I had finally mustered up the courage to ask Sean, who by now had seen Andy's records, what his chance of survival was. 80 to 85%, he cautiously offered. I felt good about our odds. Through our work, Andy and I were keenly aware of the discrimination and mistreatment that transgender people often face in medical settings. In one survey, 70% of transgender people reported experiencing some form of discrimination in a healthcare setting, including healthcare professionals refusing to touch patients. Not every health professional knew we were trans, but some figured it out, and others needed to be told. We were also cognizant of Johns Hopkins' deeply troubling history with trans people. Once a leader on gender-affirming treatment, in the 1970s and 80s, the psychiatric department had come under the control of a right-wing extremist, Dr. Paul McHugh, who, while having no expertise in gender or sexuality research, harbored strong negative feelings towards LGBTQ and particularly trans identities. He would not only close down Hopkins' work on transition-related care, he'd also go out of his way to advocate against the rights and dignity of trans people, calling us caricatures and mad. While McHugh, now much older, was no longer the head of the department, he was still teaching at the institution and a towering figure in its work. What if our providers had been acolytes of Paul McHugh's? What, if anything, might that mean for Andy's treatment? So while stressing and worrying about all the typical things patients and their loved ones must deal with when facing such a serious diagnosis and invasive surgery, with each new doctor, and later with each new nurse, we wondered, what do they think of transgender people? Will they treat us differently if or when they find out? As burdensome as these worries were, we decided that the risk was certainly not large enough to give up on the generally superior care that Andy would likely receive at Hopkins. After all, even without the Hopkins history, every interaction at any hospital would carry with it at least some of the fear we felt as we walked into the waiting room for our appointment. After an hour's wait, we were finally taken back to meet with Andy's lead doctor, a surgeon and the chair of Hopkins' head and neck department. As he began talking, he immediately put our nerves at ease. Like Sean, he was a confident and reassuring figure. He informed us that Andy would undergo the extensive surgery we had already learned about. The left half of his upper tongue would have to be removed and replaced with skin from his forearm. The cancer had, thankfully, not spread to his throat, but it had spread to some lymph nodes. The surgeon would have to remove a decent number of lymph nodes from Andy's neck, although the total number would be up in the air until they were actually in surgery. "Will I be able to speak?" Andy asked, concerned with the ramifications that not being able to talk would have on his career prospects as an advocate. "You may have a small impediment, but I think you'll regain approximately 90% of your current speech abilities," the doctor told us. Again, 90% was better than the alternative. The surgeon also informed us the neck surgery would make Andy's neck cave in a bit, and it would appear skinnier than it did now. And there would be a large rectangular wound and later scar on his forearm. Both of us were less concerned with the cosmetic outcomes than we were with the questions about his speech and, of course, his life. "We can get you in for surgery in about 2 weeks. We don't want to wait much longer," the surgeon told us. Andy took a deep breath. "Okay." Over the next several days, Andy began to prepare for his extended absence from work. After surgery, he would be out of work for his recovery, and then again for 6 weeks of extensive daily radiation and weekly chemotherapy infusions. He didn't like the idea of missing so much work. He didn't want to be left focusing solely on his cancer. He wanted, needed, distractions. So in the lead-up to surgery, I tried to give them to him. We went out to dinner most nights, knowing that he would be relegated to Ensure and milkshakes for a while after surgery, and would have to relearn how to eat with his new tongue. Just a week before surgery, we went out for our last big date before our lives would be consumed with treatment. Sean and I had been asked to speak at the Human Rights Campaign's national dinner, a 3,000-person gala for the LGBTQ civil rights group that had helped us pass our gender identity bill in Delaware. The organization was excited for our family to be able to talk about the good work HRC had done on behalf of trans rights in Delaware. And the image of an out trans woman and her openly gay brother on stage together provided the perfect metaphor for the larger movement for LGBTQ equality. Gay and trans people standing as one family. Sean and his husband Blake came down from New York. I invited my ex-girlfriend Jamie, the one who, in breaking up with me, had initiated the chain reaction that led to my coming out, as well as one of my best friends since childhood, Reed. And, of course, Andy. It was a big deal for us to be asked to speak at the dinner. It was the biggest LGBTQ equality event in the country, and it would be my first time on a national stage of that kind. I had attended the dinner the year before with White House staffers during my internship, but had only dreamed that one day I would be able to stand on stage at the Washington Convention Center. Even though I knew Andy wanted distractions, I still worried that the dinner would be too much. I feared that I was being selfish. "Are you sure you're okay doing this?" I asked him. "I can cancel." "No, this can be our last hurrah before, you know, everything," he responded. Maybe genuinely he wanted to go. He certainly wanted to get out of the apartment. But I also got the feeling that he didn't want to come between this opportunity and me. He was always so supportive of my goals. "Plus, it's a great opportunity for me to wear a bow tie," he added with a wink. Sure enough, that Saturday night he sported a dapper tux and bright green bow tie. We were led to our table near the front of the room that stretched at least 2 football fields across. I was seated between Andy and a personal inspiration of mine, civil rights legend Julian Bond. Bond had been a leader of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee with John Lewis during Selma, and later helped found the Southern Poverty Law Center, the nation's leading hate watchdog group. He was speaking that evening as well. Attorney General Eric Holder, a staunch defender of LGBTQ rights in the Obama administration, opened the evening. Chad Griffin, HRC's president, gave a rousing speech. And finally, it was time for Sean and me to go on stage. I was excited, but could feel the butterflies building. The crowd was fired up from a mix of our movement's success and the evening's remarks, along with some help from alcohol. We waited backstage as Chad finished up his remarks, and the voice of God came over the loudspeaker. "Please welcome Sarah and Sean McBride." Music started playing, and we walked out onto the stage. As I stepped up to the lectern, I could hear the song behind the applause. Purely by chance, it was Safe and Sound, the same song Andy had played for me in the car on our first date. I had never addressed such a large audience. The General Assembly in Delaware paled in comparison. My legs were shaking from nerves. I began my speech, consciously trying to speak slowly and clearly as I recounted my experience coming out at AU and the love and support my family had given me. I talked about our fight for legislation in Delaware and the historic year we had just experienced with both marriage equality and gender identity non-discrimination protections passing. I could hardly see anyone in the audience, It looked like I was speaking to a sea of black, except for the occasional light that reflected off of glasses, jewelry, or some of the shinier clothing. And just to my right, a few tables back, my eye caught Andy's green bow tie. The tone of my speech was triumphant. I talked about how excited I was for the future. I spoke about how fortunate I felt. But in reality, in that moment, I didn't feel any of those things. And I knew Andy didn't either. The words rang hollow for me that evening. I wasn't excited. I wasn't feeling particularly fortunate. I worried that my positive tone on the stage would make Andy feel even more alone in his struggle and sadness. And I couldn't shake the feeling that this might be the last night of its kind for the two of us. When I returned to our table, Andy greeted me with a kiss. He squeezed my hand and said, "You are so fantastic. I'm so proud of you, Bean." His eyes were warm, but I could see the anxiety lurking behind them. For both of us, the end of that speech marked the beginning of a new chapter, one neither of us were fully prepared for. We were focused on the first step, surgery, but we knew that would be only the beginning of a grueling several months at best. 10 days later, at 5 a.m. in a dark hotel room in Baltimore's Inner Harbor, we woke for Andy's surgery. Or, more accurately, I woke up. Andy hadn't slept a wink the night before. And as I rolled over to say good morning, I saw him sitting up and staring blankly into the darkness. "What if I can't talk anymore?" he asked. Clearly he'd been crying. "Will you still love me?" "Of course, my love," I told Andy in the darkness. "But it really doesn't sound like that will happen." I was hopeful that it wouldn't come to that, but the possibility had been on my mind. Our boss at the Center for American Progress and I had already started discussing the possibility. "If it comes to it, we'll all learn ASL," she had suggested, referring to American Sign Language. "We probably should, anyway." We met my mom, Andy's mom, Artis, and stepdad, Richard, and his aunt, Carolyn, in our hotel lobby, and made our way to the surgery center at the Hopkins Hospital campus. For the whole drive, Andy never stopped holding my hand. His palms were sweaty and his grasp tightened as we got closer to surgery. By 6:30 a.m., we were all sitting around Andy's bed in the surgery prep center. Carolyn and I exchanged jokes with Andy, who seemed to be in surprisingly good spirits. Soon enough, the jokes ended when the surgeon entered and approached Andy's bed. He asked Andy how he was feeling, then swiftly changed course to share some developments. "Based on scans from yesterday, it looks like the cancer has spread to parts of the other half of your tongue, so we're going to have to remove more than we anticipated." Andy's eyes widened at the news. "Does that change the prognosis for my speech?" "I'm afraid it may. We won't know for sure until we're in surgery, but it's difficult to say, no pun intended, I'm sure, what your speech will be like at this point." Andy looked at me with tears welling in his eyes, clearly shaken at the sudden realization that these few moments might be his last with the ability to speak. But there was no time to digest the news. Almost immediately, he was wheeled into what would be a 10-hour surgery. The surgeon had just dropped a bomb on us, and as we watched the back of Andy's bed turn the corner, we knew we couldn't do anything to calm him. The next 10 hours felt like an eternity. I tried to do some work. I texted his friends and posted updates on his Facebook page per his instructions, but it was nearly impossible to focus on anything as we waited in a bright, semi-private alcove in the larger waiting room. I knew Andy was in skilled hands, but my heart was in my throat the whole time. Halfway through, the surgeon came out to give us an update. He was confident that they had gotten all of the cancer and the removal of the tongue and lymph nodes. He was now turning Andy over to his colleague, a reconstructive surgeon, to take skin from the arm and rebuild the tongue. Another 4 hours went by. Artis played on her iPad. Richard slept in his chair. Carolyn and my mom chatted. I could only send the occasional email as my eyes kept wandering to check the time, and I wondered when we'd get the next update. Finally, the reconstructive surgeon came in and informed us that the surgery was complete. "How does it look, doctor? What do you think about his speech?" Artis, Richard, Carolyn, and my mom looked up anxiously. "I think he'll regain, functionally, his ability to speak, just with an impediment." Thank God. This was the first moment when the potential news felt more positive than negative. despite my concern that everything that could go wrong would go wrong. The news about Andy's speech was a welcome alternative to my sneaking pessimism. They wheeled Andy into a room in the intensive care unit, and the five of us were taken up to see him. Anyone who has ever visited a loved one in the hospital knows the feeling in the pit of your stomach as you prepare to see someone after an accident, illness, or surgery. I wasn't quite sure what to expect, but I was anxious to see him. He was just waking up from the anesthesia as we entered his room in the ICU. The lower half of his head and his new tongue were significantly swollen. He had staples up the side of his neck and a large bandage over his left arm. He was hooked up to a million machines and tubes, including a feeding tube through his nose and a tracheostomy tube that went up his windpipe and exited through his lower neck, allowing him to breathe as his still swollen, rebuilt tongue blocked the airway in his mouth. "You look great, Bean," I told him with a smile. "They say they got all the cancer, and the doctor says that you should get pretty much all of your speech back." He couldn't change the expression on his face, but he managed to lift up his right hand and give me a thumbs up. We had made it this far. The recovery would clearly be long and intensive, with the torture of not really being able to communicate through his swollen tongue exacerbating his frustrations. But there was certainly a light at the end of the tunnel. Hopkins would keep him for about a week, first in the ICU and then later in a private room in a more general recovery wing. We got him a whiteboard so that he could communicate with us, and he had me send pictures of him with messages of love and thanks to a few friends and family, including Sean. He didn't want anyone to worry. Over the next 7 days, with the help of a stream of dedicated nurses, Andy's physical activity increased as his tongue decreased in size and he attempted a little labored speech. Some days I'd sit by his side doing work. Over the previous month, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act had begun to move through a committee in the U.S. Senate and had made its way to the Senate floor. As he watched daytime television, I'd sit by his bedside on my laptop, crafting memos and research papers for senators debating many of the same issues we had just forged through in Delaware. ENDA had never passed the U.S. Senate, and while the prospects for passing the House were slim, very slim, we hoped we could at least push the bill through the upper chamber of Congress, building momentum for eventual passage down the road. A few days after surgery, Andy's family returned to Wisconsin, but in their place came friends and colleagues making pilgrimages to Andy's hospital room to hang out, something that made the days bearable for him. The extended stay meant a nearly constant rotation of nurses. And with each new nurse, the fears that surfaced during that first visit to Hopkins came back. Every time a new nurse would walk into his room, Andy would glance at me with a simple look that said, "Can you tell them?" For practical reasons, it was helpful for them to know that he was transgender. In the split second after I told them, I'd study their facial expressions for even the subtlest sign of discomfort. Discomfort can, even subconsciously, lead to mistreatment. Fortunately, every nurse was a consummate professional, and while we were nervous each time, they all offered no suggestion that they had any problem with who we were. A week after surgery, I got the call that both Andy and I had been hoping for. He would be discharged, probably that afternoon. I left work, which I had returned to the day before, and hurried up to Baltimore to meet Andy in his room in the general recovery wing at Johns Hopkins. He would be released from the hospital in stable condition, but still with the feeding tube, the large, shallow wound on his arm, and the tracheostomy tube. The tube had to be cleaned with an ominous gray suction machine every few hours to ensure air could pass through and he could breathe. Afternoon came and went, and we still waited to be discharged. The hospital eventually told us that the supplies for Andy's home care were not yet available. Yet they were ready to discharge him, so a nurse gathered up as many supplies as possible onto a cart and wheeled it into Andy's room. "This should hold you over until the rest of the supplies arrive and are shipped to your apartment," he told us. Andy and I both looked in terror at the cart, overflowing with clear plastic bags and containers filled with replacement tubes, food bags, wound dressings, and more. The nurse, clearly overworked and trying to do his best for us in an unfortunate situation, quickly ran me through the steps to clean Andy's tracheostomy tube, dress his wound, and change his food. By now it was dark outside. Andy was giddy with the prospect of getting out of the hospital, I felt woefully unprepared, but knew how badly he wanted to get home. And admittedly, I did too. So I packed his bag and helped him dress. In total, Andy had 4 tubes coming out of his upper body. The feeding and trach tubes, plus 2 drainage sacs coming out of his neck and collar, which presented a challenge in getting him fully dressed. After a few tries to get his arms through the sleeves, I draped his button-down shirt over his back, clipped one button closed, and attached the drainage sacs onto the shirt with pins. He looked disheveled, but it would do. Pushing the cart of supplies down the hallway, I looked back at Andy, who was a pace behind me, and noticed a small amount of light red blood coming from his mouth. I panicked, ran and got the nurse and brought him over to see Andy. "Don't worry," the nurse reassured us. "A little blood is normal. Only be concerned if the blood coming out of his mouth is thick and dark." We both exhaled and made our way slowly down to the waiting car. I drove excessively slow on Interstate 95, like a brand new parent with her baby in the car. Eventually, we pulled up to our apartment, where we found one of Andy's best friends, Wesley, waiting for us. He helped us carry the supplies up to our apartment, which Andy greeted as though he had been gone for years. He was finally home, and ready to begin his recovery on his own terms. Except now, the constant light red blood had turned into dark, thick blood, softly gushing from his mouth. Fuck. I called the resident on call at the hospital, who could, understandably, provide little guidance based on my description. I then called Sean, who recommended, as a precaution, that I take Andy to the emergency room. Wesley and I hurriedly helped Andy back to our car, and I drove the short distance to George Washington University Hospital, a central D.C. hospital known as the primary emergency location for the president. We were home from Hopkins less than 15 minutes, and now already on our way to another hospital. As we pulled up to the entrance, Andy was covered in blood, still partly shirtless, and overwhelmed with tubes. The guard at the driveway was clearly shocked by the sight of Andy and urgently told us, "Leave the car! Go straight through!" We waded through the crowd in the waiting room, hundreds of patients and family members staring at this young man and wondering, what the hell happened to this kid? His weakness was evident in his walk. It was more shuffling his weight from his left to right foot and back again, lifting each foot about an inch off the ground and forward slightly as he waddled through the crowd. A nurse who saw Andy's condition pushed a wheelchair behind him just in time for Andy to collapse into it. Still conscious, but very weak, Andy was ushered past the waiting room and sent straight into the emergency room. A cancer patient being treated by an emergency room doctor is like a criminal defendant being represented by a corporate attorney. The cancer patient's experience and needs are so far outside of the ER doctor's wheelhouse that urgent care and oncology might as well be 2 different professions. Each of the young emergency room doctors working the night shift had a deer-in-the-headlights look as they saw Andy. Since hospitals do not share records, we explained every aspect of Andy's recent medical history to the doctors to provide them with all potentially relevant information. Andy's tongue was so swollen and half of it so new that I mostly spoke for him. Several hours went by as the doctors monitored his condition. Eventually, the bleeding stopped, and they were able to determine that his new tongue was just so swollen that his teeth had lacerated it, causing the bleeding. By now it was 1 a.m., and Andy's tracheostomy tube hadn't been cleaned since the early evening, significantly more time than Hopkins told me was okay. We asked for help. The doctors and nurses looked around but could not find any suction equipment, which was strange considering we were in a hospital. His breathing still seemed okay, and eventually at 3:30 a.m., Andy was discharged and we returned to our apartment. We went straight to the bathroom to try to suction his tracheostomy tube. I unpacked the equipment as he sat down on the edge of the toilet. The suction machine looked like something out of the late 1980s. It was a dark gray plastic machine with a small motor and a clear plastic container. Coming out of the container was a long translucent tube that was meant to be stuck down the pipe coming out of the makeshift hole in Andy's neck. I tried to push it down, but it wouldn't go. I tried again. Nothing. I finally pushed it in a little, but the suction tube wouldn't go very deep. I was clearly doing something wrong, but I couldn't remember all of the instructions, It had been a stressful whirlwind of a week, and I had been awake for nearly 24 hours. I was just out of college, and it felt like this entire person's life was in my hands. No nurses, no doctors, and it was becoming slightly harder for him to breathe. I kept worrying he would stop breathing entirely, that he would die on me right then and there in our bathroom. What if he stops breathing because of me? I thought. He was clearly scared and beginning to get worried. And then I lost it. My vision became tunneled like it had when I'd first found out about his cancer, and I was pulled into a panic attack. I was so excited to have him home, but it was now hitting me just how hard this was going to be. I leaned back against the wall in our bathroom, fell to the floor, and began to cry. I can't do this! I can't do this! I had tried to be strong for Andy, and I knew his plight was much worse than mine, but it had become too much. The stress of the last 24 hours, of the last week since his surgery, and of the last few weeks since his diagnosis was too much. I didn't know what to do. In his desire to be independent and in control, he had expressed a desire to not ask his parents or family to help take care of him. Initially, I hoped to honor that wish. Maybe I could have, but during this crisis, my fears and stress took over. I need help, Andy. I can't do this on my own, I said, still sobbing. Sitting on the edge of the toilet, covered in blood, Andy looked at me with tears in his own eyes and just calmly said, as clearly as possible given the state of his tongue, It's going to be okay, my bean. I'll do whatever we need. We sat in silence for a little while as I caught my breath. We messed around with the suction equipment and his tube a little bit more, and eventually figured out, through trial and error, the proper way to keep his windpipe clear. I helped Andy to bed, where we had placed 6 or 7 pillows so he could sleep sitting up. I walked into the living room and fell asleep on the couch. By now it was 4:45 a.m. I slept fitfully for a few hours. Every so often I woke up just long enough to listen to make sure Andy was still breathing. I figured Andy had gone to sleep too. In reality, he was up writing a note. Just as the sun came up, he took out a pen and 3 pieces of orange, brown, and tan construction paper and began writing a letter he never actually gave to me. I found it several years later. My darling, it started. Yesterday was so hard. God, if every day were like that, who would want to do it? But all days won't be like this. He went into the logistics of how he'd make it all work, from the help of friends and family to bathing. I can also have help from whoever to wash my hair, and then I can clean my little tush, he wrote about washing himself. He talked about radiation treatment and his food intake, and then he closed with, Probably your biggest burden now is emotional, and that is living, but most days will be good ones. This is my way of saying that I know this is horrible and has been a disruption. But we will have more normal days, and I believe this will not need to strain you too far beyond my emotional support needs. I can't repay what you already gave me in kindness, support, worry, hope, strength, or love. But I will try with every bit of me to reply with love, generosity, kind gestures, and support. This is, has been, and will be hard. But we will thrive by calling in our forces and not just being a 2-player version of our lives for 2013 through 2014. Please don't give up. Please don't think you aren't already always giving yourself to others, especially me, because you are succeeding. And we will come out of this stronger, happier, and more in love than ever. I really believe that. I adore you with every one of my non-squamous cells, Andy Bean. The note was his plea for me to stay with him. I had never thought for an instant of leaving his side while he went through this. When I said, I can't do this, I can't do this, I had meant I need help. But he had heard, this relationship is too much for me. So on his first night home from the hospital, sitting up in our bed at sunrise in pain and still scared, Andy worried that his best friend, girlfriend, and caregiver was about to leave. I shiver at the added fear I must have caused him. Yet he responded with patience, love, and understanding. That was Andy. Chapter 9. It Hasn't Taken Away My Voice. Our apartment was now littered with medical equipment. Bandages and ointments spread across the kitchen table, cans of liquid food for his feeding tube, suction equipment for his tracheostomy tube, and without a home nurse, Andy's recovery was a full-time job for both of us. I don't know how parents, let alone single parents, do it, I routinely thought to myself. Because of the relatively newness of both our relationship and my job at CAP, I didn't qualify for family leave. As flexible as they were, I still had to go to work most days. Fortunately, our family and friends came through in a big way. Andy's Aunt Carolyn, a nurse by trade, flew back to D.C. for a few days to lend a hand. My mom came down from Delaware one weekend, and the community of friends that Andy had amassed over the previous few years took turns staying at our apartment with him while I went into the office. Many of our chosen family in D.C. were gay or trans themselves, and their support exemplified why we so often refer to LGBTQ people as the LGBTQ community. It was a structure of mutual support and care that became a hallmark of the community during the 1980s and 90s, the height of the AIDS epidemic. Ignored by their government, often rejected by their families, in the closet at work, and faced with the rapidly spreading deadly disease, LGBTQ people had stepped up for one another to provide support and care while, in many cases, multiple friends within the same chosen family passed away from complications due to AIDS. We were seeing just a glimpse of that rainbow of support that helped so many in the community get through such a tragic time. Even with the help, I shudder to think what would have happened had we worked for an employer that did not offer employees like Andy paid medical leave and had not been so flexible with my own schedule. Most Americans are not afforded similar benefits, and they may not have the network of friends able to step in either. An illness should never mean the loss of an income, even temporarily. But in many cases, it does. The days after surgery were a blur of anxiety. I'd wake up several times each night to listen for Andy's breathing. I worry something will get stuck in his trach tube and he'll stop breathing, I told my mom after a particularly fitful night of sleep. Every 2 hours, Andy needed a certain cocktail of medications and his tube suctioned. We'd change and dress his arm wound. I'd help him dress and bathe. Can you wash my tush? He'd sheepishly ask me while sitting in the tub, laboriously saying each word with his now shrinking but still swollen tongue. I could tell he felt bad that at 27 years old he was asking his 23-year-old girlfriend to bathe him. I think he worried that it infantilized him and removed the romance from our relationship. But honestly, his strength and humor through it all only made me fall in love with him even more. We are going through life and death battles most couples our age never imagine, but it brought us closer, binding us together in unique ways. It felt like we had been together for decades, and the experience aged both of us. Our spirits lifted each passing day as he regained his strength and made progress toward feeling like his old self. A week after coming home, his feeding tube and tracheostomy tube came out. 3 days after that, he gained the strength and dexterity to finally put a shirt on himself. Jubilant, he posted on Facebook. I really didn't want my next few months to be too much of this, but it will be. Sorry, y'all. I just put on a shirt for the first time since surgery, after feeling so embarrassed about being unable to dress properly for doctor's appointments and a visit to the ER. I'm so incredibly happy I cried and scared Sarah. Oops. Our eyes were always focused on the next step of recovery. And for someone as autonomous as Andy, each step toward independence felt like reaching the highest mountaintop. But we also made sure to marvel at the smallest victories. For instance, Andy was incredibly proud of himself when on medication that made him drowsy, he managed to stay awake at the movie theater on our first date night since surgery. Or the time we went out to our favorite neighborhood restaurant for his first solid food meal with his new tongue. Always in the mood for breakfast food, he conquered a plate of eggs, bacon, hash browns, and his favorite, pancakes. I'll never forget the smile on his face when he finished. The simplest pleasures became moments of personal triumph, but more than anything else, he was just excited to be gaining his independence back. I can't help but wonder what role his trans identity played in his disdain for feeling dependent. I know I personally hate to ask for help, in part because I want to prove to society that I can be strong and independent. And while dependency is not a sign of weakness in the least, in fact, it can be a sign of strength, I've talked to other trans folks who avoid asking for help for that very reason. The fear that asking for or needing help will reinforce the prejudices and negative stereotypes many people have about those of us who are trans. I know I find myself overcompensating to show society that anything they can do, I can do too. Andy, it seemed, was doing it at home as the patient. And as the caregiver, I was doing it at work, diving into my job to prove that I could do it all. Fortunately, there was a brief break in treatment before Andy would begin radiation and chemotherapy, giving him a bit of a respite, physically and emotionally. The break also happened to occur at the same time as the Employment Non-Discrimination Act reached the U.S. Senate floor. ENDA had failed by one vote in the mid-1990s, back when Ted Kennedy was the prime sponsor. Since then, Kennedy had passed away and handed the torch to a progressive senator from Oregon, Jeff Merkley. Even though it was already an incremental, piecemeal bill focusing only on employment, it was watered down even further with an overly broad religious exemption that would provide religiously affiliated nonprofits, which in many cases provide life-saving services to the public, with a special license to discriminate. It was an exemption not afforded to those same nonprofits for discrimination based on race, sex, or national origin. Even if you are affiliated with a religious institution, when you go into the public marketplace, even as a nonprofit, you shouldn't be able to discriminate. A nurse at a Catholic hospital shouldn't fear being fired from her job because she marries her wife. A custodian at a religiously affiliated senior center shouldn't lose his job because he comes out as transgender. Due to the changing attitudes in the political makeup of the Senate, 2013 was the first year in decades that ENDA had any chance of passing. CAP, the Human Rights Campaign, the National Center for Transgender Equality, and other organizations led the charge with the public, while Merkley masterfully shepherded the bill through the archaic rules of the Senate. The bill was dead on arrival in the Republican-controlled House, but passage through the Senate would help build momentum and demonstrate the bipartisan support for LGBTQ-inclusive non-discrimination protections. It would be a symbolic victory, reflecting the often glacial pace of progress in Congress. While the Democrats controlled the Senate, a supermajority of 60 votes was necessary for passage, meaning we needed at least 5 Republican votes to reach the 60-vote threshold. Still, when the Senate passed the watered-down ENDA by a vote of 64 to 32, the bipartisan result reflected a sea change in popular opinion, particularly on trans rights. 6 years earlier, gender identity had been stripped from ENDA in the then-democratically controlled House of Representatives. It was an offensive decision, throwing trans people under the bus through a compromise that singled out a class of people, trans people, for continued discrimination. Compromise is often necessary, but entire marginalized identities are not expendable chess pieces. The fact that an inclusive ENDA had now just passed the U.S. Senate without any consideration for removing gender identity demonstrated the increasing political voices of trans people, the firming up of our allies in and out of Congress, and the public's growing embrace of our rights. It also helped that organizations such as the Human Rights Campaign, which had made the mistake of continuing to support ENDA in 2007 after gender identity was stripped out, had made clear that they would never support a non-inclusive bill again, and stood firmly with the trans community. Their commitment, much like I saw in Delaware on our gender identity bill, was absolute. I joined with my colleagues around a flat-screen TV mounted on the wall at the office to watch the vote. And as the votes ticked up on C-SPAN and the gavel slammed on the Senate dais during the final vote on ENDA, I was proud and excited for the advancement. It was the first time either chamber of Congress had passed workplace protections for transgender people, And over the preceding weeks, my colleagues and I had been working overtime to make it happen, drafting memos and talking points and making visits to Capitol Hill to assuage nervous Democrats and even more anxious Republicans. The vote was a long time coming and a lot of work, but the victory paled in comparison to the feeling of pride and hope that I had felt after Delaware's Gender Identity Non-Discrimination Act was signed. Since the Delaware bill actually became law, it had a tangible impact and real protections that would help people. That the symbolic victory in the Senate on ENDA came on such a watered-down piece of legislation only added to the feeling of an empty victory. Still, in this work, you have to acknowledge the advancements, no matter how small. As quickly as we need change to come, the race is a marathon, not a sprint. And as we celebrated in our downtown office, my mind was also on Andy, wishing he could be in the office with us, watching the historic moment. That night, as we prepared for bed, Andy and I sat down and talked about ENDA. "We win when we ask for what we need, rather than what we think we can get," I vented to him, feeling emboldened by the win, but uninspired by just how limited it was. People can tell when you aren't advocating from a place of authenticity. We need to excite people, get them behind something big. "And we need protections in all areas of life, not just employment," Andy added, alluding to his work on non-discrimination protections in healthcare. We both hoped that someday the national movement would shift toward a bigger strategy, that we'd find our courage on the issue of discrimination and demand full federal equality. That night, we talked of a bill that didn't just include employment, but also shelter and public spaces, schools and hospitals, protections in all areas of life in all parts of the country. Little did we know that similar conversations were happening in other places around town as well. It felt good to talk about something beyond cancer. With his treatment moving along, I could see Andy itching to get back in the ring, but we were still only halfway through his treatment. And while we tried to always look ahead with positivity, the darkness of cancer always loomed in the background. Everything felt drenched in it, and the air always felt heavy with it. We never talked about the elephant in the room. Death was a word we still never uttered, but I imagine it was on his mind as much as it was on mine. The brief interlude between surgery and the grueling schedule of radiation and chemotherapy was a calm in the eye of a hurricane that would come back in full force in just a few weeks. And when it returned, it did so with a vengeance. After a few weeks, the radiation on his mouth and neck started to cause so much pain that it hurt him just to breathe. "It feels like I'm being stabbed in the throat," he told me. It seemed like the progress we had enjoyed was backsliding. He lost again the ability to eat solid foods. But through it all, we were determined to live as normal a life as possible. And with the holidays approaching, we were intent on celebrating as best we could. We returned to Delaware together to spend Thanksgiving with my family. A week later, his mom and stepdad came out to spend some time with him during his daily radiation treatments. Andy and I both loved Christmas, so his mom and stepdad took us to Target to buy a fake tree and ornaments. We purchased A and S ornaments and decorations that reflected our favorite shows and jokes. Finally, the medical equipment was largely gone, replaced now with holiday decorations. Donning Santa hats, we danced around the apartment and filled it with ornaments. When Andy's dad and brother were set to fly to D.C. to spend Christmas with them, I asked Andy if it would be all right if I went back to Delaware to spend Christmas Day with my parents. "I want you to stay with me," he said almost pleadingly. I'd always spent Christmas with my family. With his dad coming to town, I thought it might be a good opportunity for me to recharge a bit. But I could tell he was hurt that I wanted to go home. "Please stay, Bean," he pleaded. We went back and forth a few times. I wanted to be with my parents. He wanted me to be with him. Each of us was beginning to grow frustrated with the other. "I need a break," I blurted out, regretting almost instantly the choice of words and emotions. I had avoided expressing any exhaustion to Andy, not wanting to make him feel like a burden. I had always tried to honor the grief circle, always complaining outward, never inward. But I felt that I needed a rest in order to better care for him. He glared at me. I could see the anger and indignation brewing under the surface. You need a break? You need a break? What about my break? This is my life, he shot back, bursting into tears. There is no break for me. It was a release of all of his pent-up frustration and exhaustion, emotions that I needed to let him vent. He needed the release and certainly deserved it. Almost immediately, though, he relented. I'm sorry, Bean. I'm sorry. You should go, he told me. You never need to apologize, I told him. Part of me wanted to meet his reversal with a complete reversal of my own, committing not to leave at all. But his dad was coming to town. This would be my one opportunity to get some rest. I said I was sorry for what I had just said and how I said it. How about I just go for 2 days? I'll go up on Christmas Eve and come back the day after Christmas. How does that sound? The trip back to Delaware for Christmas was helpful, but it wasn't the escape I thought it might be. My mind was always on Andy. I constantly checked in, texting him every few hours. The Christmas 2 years ago when I had come out to my parents felt like a world away. And after my family opened presents, I looked at my phone and saw a text from Andy. I can't talk. I've lost my voice. I'm scared, it read. Since surgery, he had mostly recovered all of his speech. A slight impediment remained, like he had a few cotton swabs in his mouth, but it had largely returned. It hurts to talk? I texted, realizing I couldn't call him to get more information. When I open my mouth to talk, nothing comes out, he replied. I called Sean, who told me that it was a possible side effect of the treatment, but that it generally comes back. Generally? There was always the small risk that the radiation would permanently damage the vocal cords. Merry Christmas, Andy, I thought. The next day I met him in Baltimore, halfway between Delaware and Washington. Andy's voice had mostly returned when we met outside the hospital where he was getting his radiation treatments. Over the next few weeks, as we rang in the 2014 New Year, his voice would go in and out. Each time he'd lose his voice, he simultaneously hoped and worried, for different reasons, that it would be the last time. Fortunately, it always came back, and eventually for good. As we entered 2014, for the first time in a while, the news for Andy was all good. Early in January, I went with him and his mother to Hopkins for what would ideally be his last radiation and chemotherapy session. On most days, Andy had gone by himself, but he had company for the final few weeks as his dad and later his mom were in town. Since I had to work, I had gone to only his first several sessions. Walking into the waiting room now, 6 weeks after the start of treatment, Andy was greeted like the most popular kid in school. Hey, Andy, one patient called out. Andy, how are you doing? Asked a nurse as she walked by. Andy, my man, an older man yelled. He had clearly made an impression on the other patients and nurses. His charm, wit, and charisma were infectious even in a cancer treatment center. And as he went in for his final radiation appointment, Andy's mom and I waited with other patients and their families in the waiting room. The average age in there had to be 70. Looking around, it was clear that at 27, Andy was by far the youngest patient getting treatment. That is, until I heard the voice of a young woman from around the corner. Alex, it's time to go, the woman yelled, not unkindly. A little boy, no older than 5 years old, walked around the corner in a hospital gown and grabbed her hand. The little boy was smiling and laughing as he made his way toward a door that read, Caution, High Radiation. Any feelings of self-pity washed away. My eyes filled with tears. I sat there watching the grace of both this little boy and his mom. I knew how important insurance had been to potentially saving Andy's life. I assumed the boy in front of me likely had insurance, too. And watching the door close behind him as he walked into the radiation center, I couldn't help but wonder how anyone in this country could believe that someone, let alone a child, doesn't inherently deserve treatment for a disease that would otherwise end his life. How could anyone think that children with cancer deserve to live only if their parents are financially secure? My train of thought was interrupted when a nurse came out smiling. He's finished, she informed us. Andy's mom and I waited by the exit until Andy emerged, clearly relieved, with a big smile on his face, knowing that the treatment was now in the past. Next to the exit was a small bell with a mallet attached to the wall. It was reserved for patients finishing their, it's hoped, final treatment, a celebratory routine that exists in cancer clinics across